This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're remembering film critic Pauline Kael. She died yesterday at the age of 82. She began writing about movies in 1961. From 68 to 90, she was a film critic for The New Yorker. She was funny, irreverent, and very honest about her reactions to movies. Even people who disagreed with her taste loved to read her because she was so much fun to read and because they wanted to know what she thought and how she arrived at that opinion. We're going to listen back to excerpts of two Fresh Air interviews with her. The first was in 1985.
How do you see your role as a film critic in terms of the audience that you're writing to, the industry that you're writing about, the artist you're writing about, and the medium, you know, the medium of film?
Well, when I write, I don't think about all that. Uh-huh. I think about trying to get straight what I saw and what it means, what's it about, and what's good in it, what's awful in it. You know, trying to sort those things out in my own head as I write. But beyond that, there are larger things at work. One of them is that the critic is the only voice between the advertiser and the public. And if we're out of the way, the advertisers drown you. And they drown you anyway. But we try to intercept that sometimes. So that if there's a good small movie, the only way you'll hear a word of it is if some critics make a noise.
You write your reviews in a very colloquial style. Did you ever have to unlearn academic style? Because I know you went to college, you were a philosophy major.
That's right. Oh, sure. I had to unlearn all the ways in which we impressed our professors by using big words and fancy references. I tried to learn to write in an American style. I mean, to bring writing more in keeping with how we actually talk about the movies after we've seen them. And it took a while. At first, I was very tight, and it took some doing to loosen all that up and to feel free enough to write the way I talk. I wanted it to have the same rhythm as my spoken word, because I thought it was false to write in a different rhythm from the way I talked. And I felt that if I could do it, you know, make them one, that I might have an honest way of responding to movies. It's one of the reasons I like James Agee's criticism, because the passionate way that he wrote was truer to how we really respond to movies than the sort of cool, fake, objective style you see in most critics who are respected.
When you review a movie, you usually only see it once.
That's right.
Do you trust that initial reaction?
I think it's the best reaction I'll ever have. And I don't mean that other people need to work the way I do, but I work best that way, because when I see a movie the first time, it has all the suspense and excitement intact in it. And I think when people go back over and over, they really try to see in the movie what other people have told them is in it. And even if they didn't like it, they often, you know, begin to fake their own responses to themselves, because there is a consensus opinion that advertising and prestige develop around a certain picture, even before it opens to the public. We all know what the industry's pushing, what each company is betting on, and from the time of year they open it and how they handle it, we know, you know, what's behind it. And a lot of people fall into line with that. And if they don't really like the movie the first time, they go back. And then the second time they convince themselves that they see more in it. Often they've done an interview with the director or the stars before they've even seen it. And so they've been told all the great things that are in it. I think it's very important not to interview anybody connected with the movie before you see it, to go and then write about what you yourself reacted to from what was on the screen, and not look for that marvelous performance you've been told about. Very often it isn't there. Anyway, I simply like that full immediate experience, and I'm able to recall the movie very well from one seeing. So the only times I've ever gone back was when the review was already locked in and I needed to check that I've got a quotation straight, or that I got some point right about where a scene took place, something of that sort. So I might do that just before it's locked in at the printers, but I always write the review from the first seeing.
Do you ever go back a second time and find that that second opinion is very different from the first, and maybe you begin to doubt that first opinion?
No, I just, I don't think a movie review is fatal. I don't do any great damage to a movie by not liking it, particularly if it's a big movie. If it's a small, innovative movie or small budget movie, if I don't like it, I generally don't say so anyway. I just don't review the movie. I think the big ones, it's fair to go after if they're dogs. But the little ones, I let get away anyway. So I don't think I can do any great damage to a movie.
You didn't start writing film criticism full-time, really, for a living until you were in your mid-40s. What were some of the jobs you held before then? Were they all movie jobs?
No, some of them were. I mean, I did manage theaters very successfully for a period. I started the whole twin cinema idea in the country, which I regret now.
It's but, given way to the quadruple.
That's right, and the more than that.
That's right.
But I've done everything from working as a seamstress to working as a cook, taking care of children. I've done just a lot of crazy jobs, some of them because I had a child who needed heart surgery and who was in very bad shape, and so I couldn't put her in a nursery school. And so I took a lot of jobs that may have seemed very lowly because things I could do at home, I did a lot of. But I also did things related to movies. I programmed movies for colleges and wrote the notes for the colleges and wrote advertising copy for theaters on the West Coast and wrote catalogs for 16-millimeter distributors, all those dreary jobs. On the other hand, a lot of them I learned how to loosen up my style, and that wasn't so bad. Advertising copy can be useful in that because since it isn't going to be signed, you don't feel the same constraint you would if you were working on something you thought, this is my definitive statement.
Pauline Kael, recorded in 1985. Our remembrance will continue with a 1994 interview with Kael after a break. This is Fresh Air. Film critic Pauline Kael died yesterday at the age of 82. She retired from The New Yorker in 1991 after Parkinson's disease made it difficult for her to get around. We called her at her home in Great Barrington, Massachusetts in 1994 after the release of her anthology For Keeps, which collected about a fifth of the reviews from her entire career. She had several popular collections of her reviews with suggestive titles like I Lost It at the Movies and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. In 1994, I asked her how she saw her role as a film critic.
I really tried to give what I thought was going on in the movies and how they reflected what was going on around us and how they falsified it. And there's a lot of falsification at work. I mean, the whole way that Sylvester Stallone has come to represent what people wish the Vietnam period had been. I mean, at first it seemed a joke when he kept winning in Vietnam for us. Now he represents a spirit of winning for the whole culture. And I guess Arnold Schwarzenegger does the same thing. But those movies are essentially meaningless to people except in making them feel that there's power in these bodies and that they can identify with that power. But they come out of the movie with not much. I mean, because they don't know whether to laugh at the guys or take them seriously.
In rereading your work, did you find that there were actors, directors, or writers whose careers turned out very differently from what you expected when you were reviewing their early work?
Almost all of them, because I could not have expected that things would go to hell after the Vietnam period, that the loosening up in movies and the whole personal expression that directors were giving to movies in the 70s would turn into dust in the 80s and early 90s. And it has. I mean, the great directors have not sustained their greatness. They've become much more conventional. The people who burst through in the 70s have lost their bearings. They don't know what to express in the movies anymore, or they've given up trying, or they've fought and lost. I mean, a few flops and they lose the right to try again. Although Coppola goes on trying and trying and somehow seems to have less and less to say. But, I mean, look at someone like Scorsese, who in and Taxi Driver and Mean Streets brought something really new into films. He's become technically more expert. He's become a fantastic technician. But when he makes something like Cape Fear, he seems to forget that the purpose of the thriller is to be entertaining. It works on ugliness and dread, and you hate it. You feel you've been through something shameful. It's as if the spirit has soured in movies. When you went to a Hitchcock thriller, he teased, it was entertaining, it was titillating. When you go to a thriller now, you expect to come out feeling terrible.
I want to read something that you wrote about Mean Streets when that film came out. You wrote, though, the street language and the operatic style may be too much for those with conventional tastes. If this picture isn't a runaway success, the reason could be that it's so original, some people will be dumbfounded, too struck to respond. It's about American life here and now, and it doesn't look like an American movie or feel like one. If it were subtitled, we could hail a new European or South American talent, a new Buñuel steeped in Verdi, perhaps, and go home easier at heart. Because what Scorsese, who is 30, has done with the experience of growing up in New York's Little Italy has a thicker textured rot and violence than we have ever had in an American movie, and a riper sense of evil. Did Scorsese ever contact you after you wrote that?
Well, he contacted me. I've forgotten when it was. He contacted me, I think, after Ellis Doesn't Live Here Anymore. He disagreed with something I had said in it, in the review. But we've had cordial relations over the years, very distant but cordial, even when I've been rather unhappy about his films. And I have been unhappy about any number of them. It seems to me that he wants a career as a conventional Hollywood Academy Award-winning director, that he lost the confidence in the direction he was going in when he started. But he made a few films that will be landmarks in American movies forever, I think, and that's an awful lot to ask of anybody. I mean, we shouldn't say someone is a failure if after two or three great pieces he doesn't do any more up to that.
Does it is it hard for you when you've met a director or an actor and you like them as a person and you really admire, I mean love, some of the work that they've done, to then give a bad review?
Of course, it's painful. But it's almost worse to love somebody's work and find out you can't stand him, which often happens too. Directors are very commanding people. They're like generals of armies, and sometimes when you meet them surrounded by their pimps and sycophants, you're not too happy.
I remember the last time we spoke about, I guess it was about 3 years ago when you retired from The New Yorker, we were talking about taste and how taste can either make a relationship or come between two people who might have thought of themselves as otherwise being in love. And as a matter of fact, let me just read a short excerpt here. This is from your review of Dances with Wolves. You write, "A friend of mine broke up with his woman friend after they went to see Field of Dreams. She liked it. As soon as I got home from Dances with Wolves, I ran to the phone and warned him not to go to it with his new woman friend." And I remember, you know, the last time we spoke, you said you were even thinking about writing an article about taste, and if memory serves, you were going to write about how it affects people who are out on dates with each other, and how, like, the movie choices affect the power in the relationship, who makes the choice, and then who decides if it's a good movie. Are there people in your life where you don't want to know what their taste is so that it doesn't interfere with how you feel about them? Like if you have a doctor or something, do you want to know if he likes Dances with Wolves or not?
No. Well, let's put it this way. I want to know, but I don't want to have to talk about it.
But you don't want to choose your doctor about whether, you know, you don't want to choose your doctor based on your evaluation of his film taste.
No, I don't expect doctors to know much about movies. Presumably, they're too busy to go to them that much. But there are fields in which it's astounding to find out what people like, and it's a little depressing. It would be hard to date, I think, if you were a young woman. It'd be hard to date somebody who loved Dances with Wolves. But I wrote about that early when I wrote about someone who adored West Side Story. And I think it's always a problem for a young woman in particular dating, but men I know have problems. I know a young man who was very upset because his girlfriend didn't respond to McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and he felt it was hopeless to be with someone who didn't respond to that particular movie.
Well, do you think these strong feelings that you have about films and your kind of stupefaction when somebody likes a movie that you think is really dreadful, do you think that's ever interfered with relationships in your life?
Sure. It definitely has, because it enters into so many other areas. I mean, even a piece of music, Dido and Aeneas, was a turning point in my life when I discovered that the husband who'd bought me the recording of it that I wanted actually hated it.
And did that affect your feelings about him?
It sure did. I had thought that we saw eye to eye because he had bought it for me, and I assumed he adored it. Now, those can be terrible revelations.
Did you ever meet anybody who you truly saw eye to eye with?
No, but I meet people who were close enough, who are close enough to me, so that it doesn't make no never mind. I mean, small variations you can accept, but it would be painful, I think, to be living with someone and be unable to express your enthusiasm for certain works because they didn't share them.
Pauline Kael recorded in 1994. Kael died yesterday at the age of 82. We'll conclude our remembrance with another excerpt of our 1985 interview.
When you realized that you really loved movies and that they were important to you, did you want to make movies, or did you know right away that you wanted to be a film critic and write about movies?
Oh, no. I mean, even the thought of criticism came very late. I went to movies all my childhood. I mean, that was before the rating system kept kids out, and it was also before the era, really, of babysitters. We were a large farm family, and we all went. I was carried by my older brothers and sisters or my parents, and so I really saw movies from a very, very early age. And I did remember them very well. I remembered them better than my older brothers and sisters, which always sort of surprised them. But it wasn't until fairly late in life that I started writing movie criticism. And it was just one of those fluky things you start doing when you're trying to make a living at home. I had tried to do other kinds of writing, and I'd sort of experimented with other kinds of writing plays and essays and all. But the movie criticism started really when I was, I guess, my late 20s, early 30s. But I didn't get a professional job until much later. I was already 46 or 47 before I ever started making any money at it. When I did the radio show, I wasn't a paid contributor to Pacific. I was one of their guests. And I enjoyed writing about movies, though, and I enjoyed talking about them. And my style seemed to fall into place more easily on movies. For one thing, I'm interested in all the arts, and I think all those factors came into play. I'm interested in the theater and in opera and in painting and music. And somehow or other, movies are a way to use all of that. And I've always been interested in social and political things, and that too comes into it.
Because you have to report all the time on your own emotional reactions to a movie and your more intellectual reactions to the movie, does it ever dim your own passion for the film? Do you lose the passion when you're always reviewing and reporting on
films? No, I think you're more steeped in it, because writing about a movie, trying to evoke the sensations of that particular film, you re-experience them, and you experience them more acutely. I mean, I think writing seriously about anything you care about, you get to like it more, not less. I love seeing a good movie, because then I know I will have the fun of trying to share that experience with other people. I never go to a movie wanting it to be bad. I always go wanting it to be good, because then I'll have something new to say. I mean, an innovative movie means I'll have something new to write about. And that's the most exciting part of being a critic.
Pauline Kael recorded in 1985. She died yesterday at the age of 82. This is Fresh Air.